Indefatigable effort is another element of resistance in view of Ayatollah Khamenei. He says, "Once the Islamic Republic was a thin sapling, today it is a pure, robust, and strong tree, which no storm can root it out. Horrendous events occurred, but this nation managed to save itself in these horrendous events and move forward. In the events like the Eight-Year War, the Iranian nation stood strongly and brought the enemies to their knees. And in spite of the enemy, they did not surrender and was not brought to its knees and expanded the domain of its might and dignity. Jihad is one of the main elements of resistance in view of Ayatollah Khamenei. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says that jihad is one of the gates of paradise which Allah has opened to his special servants. One of these valiant mujahids of the resistance front was Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who received his reward through martyrdom. Ayatollah Khamenei says, Haj Qasem had been exposed to martyrdom 100 times. This was not the first time, but he was scared of nothing in the way of God, fulfilling the duty and jihad in the way of God. He feared neither the enemy nor the words of such and such, nor still the endurance of labor. Dear listeners, Martyr Soleimani has turned into the code name of resistance and jihad against oppression and sedition.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-Ardham, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat and the Sutuh. the standard time for studying the Muqaddimat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
So we are talking about prayer rules and Islamic laws about prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. If a person thinks that he has offered his Zuhr or noon prayer, and after this, so he tends to his Asr prayer or afternoon prayer, so he's busy offering it, while offering his afternoon or Asr prayer, all right, he remembers that he made a mistake, so he offered his Zuhr or noon prayer.
Mm-hmm.
All right,
yes.
What is he supposed to do? Should he stop praying and do something else, or re-offer his prayer? What?
If he thinks he has already offered the Zuhr prayer, yes?
Yes.
He realizes.
Yes.
Because I think there are two scenarios.
Yes.
Once you you offer the Zuhr prayer.
Yes.
And you think, and in the middle of the prayer, you realize that you have already offered the Zuhr prayer. Now, in this case, you cannot...
Like you are busy offering the Asr prayer right now.
Uh-huh.
And then you remember that you, you made a mistake.
Okay.
All right. So what happens here?
So you should, if you're busy offering your Asr prayer.
Asr prayer.
Okay, that's the main point, you know. So in that case, you have to change your niyyah to Dhuhr. Because you haven't offered the Dhuhr prayer. Okay?
Yes.
If you're busy offering your Asr prayer, and all of a sudden you remember that you haven't offered the Dhuhr prayer, of course, you have to change your niyyah to Dhuhr, to Zuhr. And it's not necessary to break
stop,
your prayer.
Or break the prayer.
To break your prayer or to stop the prayer.
And
begin offering the prayers all over again. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's not necessary. So it's a matter of changing your niyyah. Because you change your niyyah from Asr to Dhuhr.
Even if it happens like at the end of the prayer?
Yeah, that's something else. If there is no time left, and the time left only is sufficient for asr prayer, in that case you should continue offering the asr prayer, because if you if you do not do so, you will miss both the asr prayer as well as the dhuhr prayer. So that is the specific time. In the specific time, such a change
of niyyah. If there is a still time actually within the prescribed time for any kind of prayer, and you are busy offering the asr prayer,
yeah,
you suddenly remember that you thought that you
had offered the dhuhr prayer, but then you come to the point, to the conclusion that you had not offered,
exactly.
And you realize that you did not offer.
But you realize it at the end of the asr prayer.
Oh, that it doesn't
matter. But there is still time.
Even if you are on the fourth rakat,
right.
Okay, and before, let's say. Now, there's another thing which we need to learn, because let's say Maghrib and Isha prayer, okay? Mm-hmm. Maghrib and Isha. Maghrib consists of 3 rak'ah, and Isha consists of 4 rak'ah, okay?
Right.
Now, if you are on the 4th rak'ah, what are you supposed to do? Of course,
yes, exactly.
Before the ruku' of the 4th rak'ah, if you have not done the ruku' of the 4th rak'ah, you should sit down and change your niyyah to Maghrib.
Yes.
And complete the prayer.
I see.
And of course you need to do
say tashahud and wassalam.
Yeah, say tashahud, and of course you should perform 2 sajda of sahv, because you have done an extra, you have stood there.
Because of
unnecessary standing,
mm-hmm.
you need to offer 2 sajda of sahv.
Yes.
But the thing that you need to do is to change your niyyah from Isha to Maghrib,
yes.
From Asr to Dhuhr prayer.
But after the 4th prayer, ruku?
But if you have done the 4th ruku, it means you have already done it. You cannot do anything.
So what can you do? Like, you have to finish the...
You have to finish it.
Isha prayer.
Yeah, you have done it because you have already offered the Isha prayer. And after you finish it, you give the salam, then you will need to offer the Maghrib prayer.
Yes, if there's time. Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, Sheikh, and then we'll be back. Stay with us.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, here in the studio with us, talking about the prayer rules according to Ayatollah Khamenei. In the earlier part of our program, Sheikh, I asked you a very complicated question. And now let's talk about or think about another scenario, all right?
Good.
That if a person starts the Zuhr prayer, and then... while praying, he remembers that he has already offered the Zuhr prayer.
Good.
Okay? So, what can he do? Can he change his intention now to the Asr prayer?
No. Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, is of the view that he cannot change his niyyah from Zuhr to Asr prayer. You know? Because he's already offered the Dhuhr prayer, and a change of niyyah cannot happen. You cannot change your niyyah. Because there's one general point, there's one general criterion that we need to take into consideration. We cannot change our niyyah from ihtiyat to wajib prayer.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot change our niyyah from wajib to ihtiyat or from wajib to mustahab prayer. We cannot change our niyyah from mustahab to obligatory prayer. Okay, if you are offering, let's say, 2 rakahs of nawafil,
yes,
and you want to change it into 2 rakahs of fajr prayer,
yes,
it's not permissible.
Uh-huh.
But you can offer, you can change your niyyah from wajib to wajib prayer. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, you are supposed to offer dhuhr prayer, you are busy offering asr prayer, okay?
Yes.
And you realize that you have not done, you have not performed the dhuhr prayer. You can change your niyyah from the asr prayer to the noon prayer. But not from the noon to asr prayer.
So you mean a backward kind of intention changing is possible, but you cannot change your intention forward.
Yeah, forward. Uh-huh. Like you have offered dhuhr prayer.
Yes.
And you realize that you have already offered it.
Yes.
And you are busy offering dhuhr prayer. You want to change it, change the niyyah, because you are about to finish the prayer and okay, it's kind of very difficult for you to repeat the dhuhr to ask prayer again. You want to change your niyyah from dhuhr to ask prayer. That's not permissible.
So what should you do in this case?
Your prayer is wide. Uh-huh. Your prayer is invalid.
So you have to break it then.
You have to stop praying and then offer your ask prayer from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much for your nice explanation on this. And another question is that, Sheikh, how many rak'ahs are in the nafla of night or tahajjud prayer?
Well, tahajjud prayer or nawafil, generally speaking, there are many, many nawafil prayers, okay?
Yes.
For example, if we just give a short account of the nawafil prayers, of course, there are 8 rak'ahs in for dhuhr prayer, which is offered before the Zuhr prayer, and there are 8 rak'ahs of Nawafil prayer which are offered before the Asr prayer. There are 4 rak'ahs of Nawafil prayer which are offered after the Maghrib prayer, and there are also 2 rak'ahs of Nawafil prayer which are offered after Isha prayer, and also there are 2 rak'ahs of Nawafil prayer which are offered, you know, before the Fajr prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So these are every obligatory prayer has Nawafil, okay? There are Nawafil prayers with every obligatory prayer. Some are offered like before the prayer, and some are offered after the prayer. Like for example, the Dhuhr and Asr prayer, the Nawafil which come with the Dhuhr and Asr prayer are offered before the main obligatory prayer.
Mm.
But those which come with the Maghrib and Isha prayer, they are offered after the those 2 prayers.
I see.
And as far as the Nawafil for the Nafila for the Fajr prayer is concerned, it's offered before the Fajr prayer. Now when it comes to the Nawafil, the night Nawafil, or which they call it
the night prayer,
Salat al-Layl, or they call it Salat al-Tahajjud, you know, the word Tahajjud is very commonly, it's better known, you know, in many countries like India and some Muslim countries.
Mm-hmm.
So of course there are 11 rakats in Tahajjud prayer or Namaz al-Shab or Salat al-Layl, okay?
Mm-hmm.
8 rakats are offered like Fajr prayer. They are offered, all the Nawafil prayers are always offered in twos, in two rakats. So 8 rakats are offered like Fajr prayer.
Yes.
So you need to offer four prayers, and each prayer has to be offered in 2 units.
Yes.
2 rakats. And there's one prayer which is called Salat al-Shafa. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It has a different name.
Yes.
And it is offered with the niyyah of Shafa. And then there is also another prayer, 1 rakat prayer, which is called Salat al-Witr. Witr, okay?
Yes.
Witr prayer.
Okay.
Witr prayer consists of 1 rakat only. And of course, during Witr prayer, you need to pray for mu'mineen, for those whom you know. And that's the last rakat. And these 11 rakats must be offered. Of course, there's no must about the obligatory prayers. There's nothing mandatory about the obligatory prayers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When I said must, I mean that it's better for mu'mineen to offer them before the Fajr prayers. And if they don't have time to offer them before the Fajr prayers, of course, they can offer them at any time after Maghrib, after Isha prayers.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. For your nice contribution, and thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun man la ilaha illa hum ghaffarun jameelun wahhabun la
تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Desmond Tutu, South Africa's anti-apartheid icon, died on Sunday at the age of 90 after a protracted fight with prostate cancer and infections in a hospital in Cape Town. Tutu was the first Black Anglican Archbishop of South Africa. He labored relentlessly and nonviolently to bring down South Africa's brutal, decades-long apartheid dictatorship that oppressed its black majority, which ended in 1994. He was noted not just for his part in bringing an end to a dark chapter of racial discrimination in his country, but also for speaking out against injustice across the world, notably in West Asia. Tutu was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 for his nonviolent opposition to apartheid. A decade later, he witnessed the ends of that regime. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said Tutu's death marks another farewell to a generation that has struggled for the liberation of South Africa. He described Tutu as a man of extraordinary intellect, integrity, and invincibility against the forces of apartheid. Ramaphosa added that Tutu was also tender and vulnerable in his compassion for those who had suffered oppression, injustice, and violence under apartheid, and oppressed and downtrodden people around the world.
You know, there's a number of things that leaves behind. One is that particularly during the anti-apartheid struggle, he showed and demonstrated the relevancy of black theology and African theology onto the situation, onto the context. He was able to help define the struggle, not in a way in which someone who was an oppressor would define it, but in some ways of someone who was struggling against the oppressor and against oppressive theology. I mean, he was very much a backbone of the anti-apartheid struggle. His voice was clear and clarion, and obviously he used the weight of his religious office, his ecclesiastical office, to elevate the issues around apartheid and the need to dismantle it.
Tutu was also an outspoken critic of Israeli crimes against Palestinians. He believed Palestinians have been subjected to Israel's systematic humiliation, similar to the one practiced in apartheid South Africa. Archbishop Tutu was an outspoken critic of Israeli occupation in Palestine and the siege on Gaza. He compared Israel's treatment of the Palestinians to the apartheid regime that discriminated against blacks in his native South Africa. Tutu led a UN fact-finding mission to investigate a November 2006 Israeli attack on Gaza's Beit Hanun district that led to the deaths of 19 Palestinians, including 7 children. In a May 2008 statement about his mission, the Archbishop decried the Israeli siege on Gaza, in place since 2007, as a gross violation of human rights. He also said the Israeli siege contradicted the Jewish and Christian scriptures, most recently in an article published in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz in 2014. Desmond Tutu declared his support for the international movement of boycott, sanctions, and divestment as a peaceful means of opposing the Israeli occupation.
Well, I mean, he related what was going on in Palestine to what he had struggled against in South Africa, which was, again, apartheid, or the separation of people, or segregation, as we call it in this country, and Jim Crow in this country, apartheid there in South Africa. He saw it, he recognized that. He said basically that it was no different, and in fact, what was going on in Palestine was just as bad, if not worse, than what was going on, had gone on in South Africa. And so it was clear his eyes were eyes that were seasoned in the struggle. When I say seasoned, had gone through it, was able to recognize the dynamics of it, the violence of it, the racism in it, the white supremacy that existed in it, and he called it for what it was. That did not win him a whole lot of friends in those ranks, but because of who he was, the weight of his words and his perspective could not be denied.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu's death on Sunday sparked tributes from world leaders. Pope Francis sent his condolences, hailing his peace-building efforts. UN Chief Antonio Guterres hailed Tutu as an inspiration to generations worldwide and unwavering voice for the voiceless. The United Nations General Assembly has backed an open-ended war crimes probe against Israel, including into the regime's recent 11-day war on the besieged Gaza Strip that killed at least 260 Palestinians, including over 60 children. An overwhelming majority of 125 countries voted in favor of the investigation. It was initially approved by the UN Human Rights Council in the aftermath of the Gaza War in May. The inquiry allows for a review of Israeli human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories. No such open-ended investigation has ever been launched against any other UN member. The vote came after Israel's amendment to defund the probe was rejected 125-8 with 34 abstentions. Israel itself and the United States were among the few that voted against the approval of the budget for the investigation. Palestine's permanent ambassador to the UN, Riyad Mansour, praised the vote and all the countries that rejected Israel's proposal. He thanked the UN General Assembly for approving all budgets of the programs relating to the Palestinian cause, including his request to increase funding to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees. Meanwhile, the U.S. envoy to the UN, who voted against the probe, said Washington will continue to oppose the investigation and to look for opportunities in Geneva to revisit its mandate. This is another example of how Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any prosecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes. Speaking of vetoes, the United States has vetoed dozens of United Nations Security Council resolutions critical of Israel, including at least 53 since 1972. Washington's unequivocal support of Israel has seen it thwart resolutions condemning violence against Palestinian protesters as well as illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank built since 1967. The U.S. has vetoed at least 4 UN Security Council resolutions condemning Israel's settlements on Palestinian land, which are considered illegal under international law. The U.S. support of Israel also has encouraged settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis.
Israel will prevent any participation by people, by investigators,
I don't think Israel will allow them into the country, whether it's this year or next year. As long as they have the backing of the United States, they continue to be able to refuse to deal with international condemnation and international investigation of the undoubted crimes that go on a daily basis against the Palestinian people.
Last week, to mark the fifth year since the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling for an end to all settlement activities in the Palestinian territories, UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Michael Link, issued a statement calling on the international community to hold Israel accountable for its occupation of Palestine. He stated that one statistic above all illustrates the remarkable reluctance of the international community to enforce its own directions respecting the Israeli occupation. According to his statement, when Resolution 2334 was adopted in 2016, there were an estimated 400,000 Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank and 218 in East Al-Quds. 5 years later, there are 475,000 settlers in the West Bank and 230,000 in East Al-Quds, an increase of 12%. The surge in the number of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories shows how Tel Aviv ignores the 2334 resolution that states Israeli settlements constitute a flagrant violation under international law, and that all settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Al-Quds, must immediately and completely cease.
What allows the State of Israel to ignore the UN, many UN resolutions condemning the actions taken by Israel against the Palestinians on many different fronts, what allows Israel to continue to do that is the support that it has from the United States, that it's under the umbrella of United States protection. It's almost like Israel is the 51st state of the United States, the way that it's treated by the U.S. government. And this goes through Republicans and Democrats over the years. And so what it's done is it allowed these atrocities to go on.
Concluding his statement, the UN official said only an approach based on accountability, equality, and full rights for all can create the possibility of a prosperous and shared future for Palestinians and Israelis alike. But Tel Aviv has invariably avoided all attempts at bringing it to account over its decades-long aggression against Palestinians and other regional nations, thanks to staunch support by its oldest and strongest ally, the United States.
Prison is a disturbingly common experience for Palestinians. Since 1967, around one-fifth of Palestine's population has, at one time or another, been imprisoned. But the issue of Palestinian prisoners went viral on September 6th when the alarm at Israel's heavily guarded Gilboa prison went off following a jailbreak by six Palestinian inmates. Israeli authorities launched a manhunt for the inmates and toughened the situation for the rest of the prisoners, which prompted protests and hunger strikes that lasted for weeks. The spotlight, however, fell on six hunger-striking Palestinian prisoners who were protesting their detainment without any trial under an Israeli policy dubbed administrative detention. On November 7th, some 4,500 Palestinian inmates went on a day-long hunger strike in solidarity with the six. Two of the hunger strikers, who had refused to eat for over 3 months straight, were later released. The strikes have shed new light on the plight of Palestinians in Israel's massive prison system, which currently holds over 4,500 political detainees and inmates on dubious charges. On top of that, Palestinian residents have been subject to violence by Israeli settlers who remain immune from any consequences. If anything, like the raid on the Palestinian village of Jalud in mid-May, Israeli troops come to the aid of the settlers and arrest the victims, not the aggressors. Rights groups say violent settlers are just another tool in Israel's inventory to remove the Palestinians from their lands. Their population is growing fast as the number of settlements built and planned to be built on the occupied territories are rising sharply. Israel pressed ahead with its land grab and expansionist policies like the many years before. It has razed, forced people to demolish or seize multiple Palestinian-owned structures, including in East Al-Quds. In fact, such practices by Tel Aviv increased about 21% in 2021 compared to the year before. Israel has been increasingly evicting Palestinians from their homes, arguing that they lack permits. But it's virtually impossible for the Palestinians to obtain permits in areas including Area C and East Al-Quds. The evictions are usually done on such short notice that the residents cannot take the matter to the court. The United Nations says Israeli authorities have refused to grant permits to at least a third of Palestinian homes in East Al-Quds, potentially placing over 100,000 residents at risk of displacement. Israel's plans to evict several families from the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, however, sparked an outcry that reverberated across the international community. Protests against the plan, especially those around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, turned violent, with Israeli troops cracking down on Palestinian demonstrators and storming the holy site in early May. That coincided with the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. The tension sparked a conflict between Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip and the Israeli military in what turned into an 11-day war on the besieged enclave. The Israeli army razed several structures in the Strip, including a high-rise building that housed the office of several media outlets in Gaza, including the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. The Israeli atrocities drew widespread condemnation, with people around the world holding rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Some observers believe the war was a distraction from a lingering political uncertainty in Israel and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's decision to postpone parliamentary elections that could have been a referendum on his rule. 2021 was a tragic year for Palestine. The events that unfolded over the past year proved that despite what some Arab nations claim, their normalization with Israel did not help the Palestinian cause, but might have even emboldened Tel Aviv to escalate its aggression on the Palestinians. The past year, however, was a year of unity and solidarity too, with Palestinians concluding that resistance is the only means to truly stand against the occupation and fight for freedom. The incidents and headlines in the past 12 months also raised awareness for more people across the world of how life is like for a Palestinian.
Iran's Prime Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the Islamic Republic will continue sanctions removal talks in the Austrian capital with seriousness. The Iranian Foreign Minister emphasized that Tehran will never give excessive concessions to the opposite side. Iran's Foreign Minister then criticized non-constructive stances taken by some European signatories to the nuclear deal with Iran during the previous round of talks in Vienna. In the previous negotiations, the positions taken by some European countries, especially by the French, were in general not constructive. We expect the French side to focus on playing a constructive role and help the progress of the negotiations. He also criticized the European side for not putting forward any new initiative in the talks.
I think the Europeans proved that they are unreliable since 2018 and throughout 2021, because when President Donald Trump rejected the JCPOA unilaterally, the European states who signed the JCPOA did not honor their signature and did not commit to what they have agreed upon with Iran. Therefore, it is absolutely clear that Iran cannot rely on the European states, particularly now we're talking about France and Germany, including Great Britain, that is no longer part of Europe, but it is within the European continent and it's one of the countries that signed the JCPOA.
The top Iranian diplomat recommended that the five remaining signatories to the JCPOA should have no doubt that if they want to give one concession and get 10 concessions in return, the Islamic Republic of Iran will never accept such an approach. The other parties are continuously doing interviews saying that they are worried about the progress of Iran's nuclear program. We announce it loudly that if you want to alleviate your concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program, all JCPOA-related sanctions against Iran must be removed. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue its strong talks in a logical manner until a good deal is reached. The Opinion Union's Deputy Foreign Policy Chief, Enrique Mora, who represents the bloc in the Vienna talks between Iran and the P4+1 group of countries, and the EU Foreign Policy Chief, Josep Borrell, are reported to be making efforts to focus on the negotiations with seriousness. Iran and the five remaining parties to the JCPOA resumed talks in Vienna on November 29, after a five-month hiatus, marking the first round of negotiations under President Ebrahim Raisi's administration and the seventh overall. During the seventh round of the Vienna talks, Iran presented two draft texts which addressed separately the removal of U.S. sanctions and Iran's return to its nuclear commitments under the JCPOA. Iran and the P4+1 group of countries resumed the talks at the Austrian capital on December 9, when the participants returned to their capitals for additional consultations on the two draft proposals that Tehran had put forward. Since the U.S. administration under Donald Trump pulled out of the JCPOA in 2018, the EU refused to play a constructive role to revive the deal. The European side pledged to do business with Iran through a mechanism which came to be known as the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges, or INSTEX, but the project ultimately failed due to the inaction of the European side and U.S. pressure, leaving Iran with no options but to scale back its JCPOA commitments within the limits of the deal. Meanwhile, the European Court of Justice has said that European companies can end contracts with Iranian firms pressured by U.S. sanctions if upholding the deals would lead to disproportionate economic loss. The judgment from the court in Luxembourg was prompted by a lawsuit from the German branch of Iran's state-owned bank Meli against Deutsche Telekom after the telecommunications provider terminated a contract with the bank in 2018 prior to its expiry.
The position of the European court, it's an indication that Iran cannot trust to sign any future deal with any European company, because although the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg accepted the lawsuit forwarded by the German branch of Iran Bank Meli against the Deutsche Telekom, however, the decision of the European bank is shameful.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Swimming in sub-zero temperatures can be unimaginable for most people, but not for a group of athletes who've tested their skills and strength in Prague's Vltava River. 360 people from eight countries gathered in the Czech capital to participate in an annual winter swimming event. The air temperature was minus 6 degrees Celsius, with water temperatures dipping to as low as 3 degrees. The event honors Alfred Nikodem, a Czech swimmer who braved the frigid waters in Prague for the first time in 1923, starting a tradition that has been kept alive ever since. Now, the world's most powerful observatory is finally on its million-kilometer journey after several technical delays. The NASA telescope named James Webb blasted off into orbit on Saturday, heading to an outpost that's 1.5 million kilometers away from Earth. The observatory was in the making for some three decades and cost about $10 billion. It left Earth enclosed in a rocket and from a launch pad in South America. The journey will last a month. The telescope is the size of a tennis court. And if everything goes according to plan, it will enter service in June. Astronomers are hoping they can learn more about the origins of the universe once it starts beaming back new clues. A school in Spain is offering students an opportunity to join a special orchestra. The project dubbed The Music of Recycling brings unwanted junk back to life by transforming them into musical instruments. And here is how they sound. The project offers the instruments to the orchestra in one of Madrid's most disadvantaged neighborhoods. The students say the orchestra keeps them away from mischief and out of serious trouble while giving them an artistic outlet. Several dozens of children are taking music classes from members of the orchestra as part of the project. The ensemble has put on several concerts across Spain, but because of the pandemic, they had to pause their performances. The project is run by Spanish environmental group and is inspired by similar orchestra in Paraguay. To most people, an eggshell is something that gets tossed in the garbage, but to one Chinese artist, the delicate eggshell is the chosen canvas to express art and create mini masterpieces. Zhu is a talented craftsman who has created a series of unique egg sculptures with the theme of Beijing's Winter Olympic and Paralympic Games. Icons of ice and snow sports, as well as etchings of the 2022 Olympic mascots, are showcased in this series. The thin and delicate texture of the shells adds to the difficulty of the craft, which creates a sense of fragile beauty. Zhu says his fascination with eggshell art started when he was very young.
The Christmas season is when people around the world left out a dose of joy in the form of Santas. But it's different in central Thailand on this Christmas Eve. Thai children were ecstatic to see Santa Claus's distributing presents, but this time in the shape of elephants. Dressed in Santa costumes, five elephants carried dolls, face masks, and sanitizers for students. They were surrounded by many human Santa Clauses as well. But the students cheered with joy while reaching out for presents from the jumbos. Event managers say their goal was to encourage students to stay vigilant during the pandemic, plus they wanted to give the children some fun to look forward after months of virtual classes. The event is a yearly highlight for a school that caters to students from kindergarten to secondary level.
Scientists have made a stunning discovery inside a fossilized dinosaur egg. An embryo that's been preserved in a perfect shape. The embryo was found inside a 66-million-year-old fossil in a museum in the Chinese city of Guangzhou. Paleontologists say it's the best dinosaur embryo ever found. They're hoping it would help a lot in finding the links between modern birds and dinosaurs. The fossil belongs to a toothless Oviraptorosaur, a group of feathered dinosaurs that used to live in what's now Asia and North America. The embryo is nicknamed Baby Yin Liang after the Chinese museum that houses the fossil.
After almost 2 years of isolation due to the coronavirus pandemic, Mexicans are once again celebrating Christmas together in a fair in the capital, Mexico City. Here's more.
It is a joy that we've been planning for a long time to go out and to take this picture because we've been locked up for 2 years and we couldn't go out. Now there's green light. We decided to go out with the whole family to live these moments together.
A few things are different in the fair as far as Mexican tradition goes. Santa, and not the traditional three wise men, give out presents. Families also have their photos taken by the Father Christmas. These are rare moments amid the coronavirus pandemic. The attendees say the situation is complicated, but they will try their best to make it work. The festival has been made possible by the introduction of green passes, which indicate full vaccination against COVID.
Exchanging gifts is an inseparable and also the most joyful part of Christmas traditions. How about sharing the joy with animals? Now, a zoo in the Colombian city of Cali is doing so by giving presents to its animals. The presents are actually the animals' favorite foods served in a different way. Animals spend time unpacking the gifts decorated in Christmas theme, and then access the food they like the most. Feeding in this way arouses the animals' curiosity and fills them with excitement. Zookeepers say they want to show that animals always receive care at their zoo.
It is a very cool way to generate empathy for visitors. Although animals do not know that it's Christmas or that it's a special date, it is important to generate that message in visitors that we make care of our animals, and that for us it is important to share with them this Christmas season.
The zookeepers say they make use of enrichment strategies for their initiative. They actually stimulate the behaviors of a range of animals, even the species they keep in an aquarium. Running a marathon is pretty tough for most, but a group of people has upped the ante to take the competition to sub-zero temperatures of Antarctica. 62 people descended on the Union Glacier from around the world and ran over a 42-kilometer course. The area is just a few hundred kilometers from the South Pole. Soft snow and temperatures as low as minus 15 degrees Celsius did not stop Latvia Evia Rain from setting a women's record. The event was delayed for several days because of a massive storm that battered the area a week ago. Adventurers and athletes have been putting their strength to the test in the race every year since 2005.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A tiny baby mouse deer takes its first steps into the world with a round body and spindly legs in a Polish zoo. It was born on December 2nd and now stands roughly 10 centimeters tall. The Warsaw Zoo got its first mouse deer last year and a second one last summer. Zoo staff are surprised that the pair of new arrivals have produced offspring so quickly. Mouse deer are among the smallest mammals. Even as adults, they only weigh around 2 kilograms. Contrary to their name, they are neither from mouse nor from deer species. Some mammalogists consider them living fossils because they haven't evolved much over millennia. Beachgoers in Brazil's Rio de Janeiro have been surprised by very rare visitors, a family of orcas. The family of three was seen swimming in shallow waters of a crowded beach south of the city. The group didn't seem to care at all about the presence of people on their paddleboards. Footage of the orcas quickly spread on social media because they don't usually come that close to the coast. A local biologist says the whales were likely to drawn. They were likely drawn to the area by a cold current from further south.
What we see in the video is a family group that has a male and a female who have a calf. It is common that the orcas come from a colder current where there is also a shoal, and they reach the south, the north in fact, and end up hitting our coast. Then they rest in warmer waters such as Copacabana Beach, Ipanema Beach, and Barra da Tijuca.
The biologist says the mammals pose no risk to humans despite the label killer whales. He says there is no record of their attacks on humans. Researchers suspect that the migration patterns of whales could be influenced by climate change and the resulting changes in water temperatures. Serving customers in a high-tech way. That's what a traditional restaurant in the German state of Bavaria does. What's the goal? The owner explains.
We decided ourselves for this robot because of the lack of staff. We looked for support in a technological form. It's not a replacement, of course, but it's a relief for the waiters.
The robot is equipped with a trolley and it can easily move around in the restaurant. When it comes to saving time, the high-tech waiter is of great help, especially when the restaurant is packed with customers. The owner says most customers first become surprised when they come across the robot. He says waiters are still present to serve meals and receive orders. Butterfly gardens are a place where you can watch these tiny creatures and marvel at their beauty. But have you ever wondered where these butterflies come from? These colorful creatures are in fact bred in butterfly forms. And Donald Orsay from Costa Rica is one of the biggest breeders, making that the mission of his life. He produces somewhere around 2,500 pupas per week. Orsay is one of the world's largest exporters of the popular Morpho species. Listen to him explain why he is fascinated by them.
A morpho has a great advantage. It is a butterfly that rarely stays still, unless it is very late, because when it is getting dark, it settles down, but normally it flies constantly. It flies by in the butterfly gardens.
Arce's butterflies have their own special diet. They feed on bananas and a concoction that he keeps its ingredients secret. Morphos are popular because of their color. They are shimmering blue on one side and brown on the other side. That's perfect for camouflage. Butterflies are really fun to watch, but they serve a critical purpose as well. They help plants reproduce by pollination, thus strengthening the ecosystem.
A few hooks and a shelf have transformed a wall in the Swedish capital, Stockholm, into an outdoor charity. It's called the Wall of Kindness, which is painted with the slogan, "Grab a jacket if you need one, leave a jacket if you can spare one." Here people can donate their winter clothes or warm boots if they have some extra. The Wall of Kindness is meant to help those in need, including the homeless, to stay warm. The wall was set up by a real estate company, and the organizer says people have responded positively with the high turnover. The move was inspired by a trend that has been seen in Iran over the years. Several other countries across the world, such as India, have also organized similar outdoor charities.
Scientists in Brazil have come up with a creative way to shore up the population of a majestic species of monkeys in danger of extinction. Brazilian conservationists have constructed a bridge to reconnect the two sides of Rio de Janeiro's Atlantic forest. The road had effectively isolated a group of lion tamarins, but now it offers hope for the endangered monkey. There are only 2,500 golden tamarins left in the wild, all of them in Brazil. It is estimated that these animals have lost more than 95% of their habitat.
IRIB English Radio.